Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Juneteenth, and it's more than a date on the calendar. It's a story of delayed freedom and enduring courage. Tonight at the Farm Arts Collective, an evening of poetry, music, and powerful storytelling brings that history to life. Emmy Award-winning journalist and historian and host of the Janice Adams Show, Janice Adams, joins us to reflect on the meaning of Juneteenth and what we can learn from the past. As the Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg this weekend, artist and writer David Dan unveils The Clock, a thought-provoking installation bending time and challenging perception. We'll learn more about Mr. Dan's work. And for over half a century, the Wayne Corollaires have been a beloved part of the Wayne County Creative Arts Council's summer concert series. We'll learn more about the upcoming events and the history of the council after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Iran continue to fire missiles and drones at each other. Israel says it has struck a nuclear reactor in Iran. Details about damage in Iran are scarce. Overnight, Iranian officials blocked access to the internet in their country. President Trump has made very opaque remarks about his thinking about the conflict between Israel and Iran. He's continued to leave the door open for U.S. troops to join Israel in striking Iran. This morning, Trump chided the Wall Street Journal. It's been publishing editorials about the conflict. Writing online, Trump says the paper has no idea what his thoughts are concerning Iran. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says Iranian missiles hit a large hospital in southern Israel, wounding dozens of people. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports.
Soroka Hospital is the largest medical facility in the southern Israeli city of Beersheba. This is the first hospital in Israel to be directly hit since the war began, according to the Israeli military. Videos posted online showed footage of extensive damage to the inside of the hospital, as well as black billowing smoke. Iran state media said it had targeted an Israeli military site and not the hospital. A high-rise building in Tel Aviv was also struck. Israeli airstrikes hit Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the latest target in Israel's campaign on Iran's nuclear facilities. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
There's a growing divide on Capitol Hill over whether President Trump should authorize a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports some lawmakers are backing the need for a strong response, while others are warning the United States is risking being pulled into a broader conflict without a clear strategy.
Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He told NPR on Wednesday that Israeli strikes are just the beginning and U.S. involvement may be necessary to complete the mission.
We all knew that they would not fully be able to do it without U.S. involvement. And if that is what is required to finish the job, I fully support it.
The top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith of Washington State, says any decision to attack Iran should go through Congress.
I don't think that we should get directly involved in attacking Iran. And if the decision were to be made to do that, I think Congress should under the Constitution, our approval should be required.
At the heart of the debate is whether a president needs congressional approval to launch a strike. The White House hasn't outlined a legal argument yet, but past administrations have leaned in on the use of the authorization for use of military force. That power was first used in 2001 in Afghanistan after 9/11. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The stock market is closed today in honor of Juneteenth. You're listening to NPR. The trust fund that helps cover Social Security benefits is expected to run out of money in about 8 years. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that's slightly earlier than trustees were projecting just a year ago.
An updated forecast says unless Congress acts by 2033, the benefits that more than 60 million retirees and family members receive will be automatically cut by 23%. That deadline's about 9 months earlier than trustees projected last year. That's largely because of a new law that increased benefits for nearly 3 million people who had pensions from jobs not covered by Social Security. Trustees also lowered their forecast of future wages and birth rates. Congress could patch the hole in Social Security's finances by raising taxes, reducing benefits, or some combination of the two. Trustees urge lawmakers to act sooner rather than later so people have more time to prepare. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Today will be a scorcher in the Upper Plains. The National Weather Service has issued extreme heat watches for parts of Kansas and Iowa to Minnesota's northern border with Canada. Heat index values could rise above 100 degrees. Extreme heat warnings are posted for much of southern Arizona and areas around Death Valley, California today. The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Eric has made landfall on the southern Pacific coast of Mexico. Top sustained winds are 125 miles per hour. That means Eric is a major Category 3 storm. At one point, Eric was a Category 4 storm with top winds of 140 miles per hour. Forecasters are warning of heavy storm surge. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Today is June 19th, commemorating the day in 1865 when the last enslaved people in the United States finally learned they were free 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. To mark the occasion, Farm Arts Collective in Damascus, Pennsylvania, is hosting a powerful evening of truth-telling, music, and memory this evening. The event includes a Lenape opening ceremony, poetry from Langston Hughes, multimedia storytelling, and reflections on race, freedom, and resilience. Joining us now is Emmy Award-winning journalist, historian, and host of the Janice Adams Show, Saturdays at 11 here on Radio Catskill. Dr. Janice Adams, she's taking part in the evening, and she's joining us now to talk about the meaning of Juneteenth, the history, and what audience can expect from the celebration at Farm Arts. Janice, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me this morning and commemorating Juneteenth.
And I think that, you know, to start our conversation out, you wanted to actually read the proclamation that the folks heard in 1865 when those last enslaved people in the U.S. were finally learning they were free.
Yes. It is interesting. Of course, the Emancipation Proclamation, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, was handed down. It literally came across the wires the night of December 31st, 1862, January 1st, 1863, and there was a lot of anticipation about it. But that Emancipation Proclamation only freed people where he had no jurisdiction to free them, meaning in the Confederate states. And so that was an iffy proposition, but it was symbolic, and it had its repercussions nationwide. On June 19, 1865, after the war was won by the North, by the Union, troops had to go out and actually tell people they were free. Because, of course, the slave owners were not going to tell them that and did not tell them that. And so General Gordon Granger arrives in Galveston, Texas. That's the last outpost that of the Confederacy that where people still need to be warned or not warned, but they need to be notified. You are now and forever free. And here's the order. The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. Now, that is what is read to the last surviving victims of a 246-year reign of terror called American slavery, before went from the colonial era through the Revolution and actual union as the United States of America. 246 years, this country and its predecedent were enslaving people, treating them in the worst possible way, and this is the notice that is read to them. We will not support idleness. Go back and work for the people who've exploited you and work for wages. So it was really a setup for some of the things that we are still experiencing, that condescension, that racism. It's there. Mm.
Why do you still think it's a misunderstood or an overlooked legacy of Juneteenth in our country today?
Well, I'll say that, first of all, I was shocked because this was the first time in years that I had ever thought to just pull up that Granger statement. And it was because I was preparing for this evening at Farm Arts. So I really was just saying, oh, well, let me read it, just the way I have the Emancipation Proclamation, and we always look to that. Let's pull up the Granger Statement. I was shocked to hear the tone of the way these people were treated. So I think basically, in short answer, it's because we had not read that document. On the other hand, it's the only thing we have. It is a major turning point in the history of this country. It is an acknowledgement that this madness called the American slaveocracy has to stop. It has to end. But the benefits are still inuring to the oppressors, not to the oppressed.
Which, as you said, brings us to today. The more things change, the more they stay the same. You've got some audio of upstate tour. Yeah.
Go on. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say we have some audio of you and Jason Dole traveling upstate in New York to the Underground Railroad and other human rights related sites that you wanted to play as well during this acknowledgement of the day.
Yes, I do, because there's an interesting connection to it. The actual Emancipation Proclamation is signed not just by Abraham Lincoln, but also by his Secretary of State, William Seward. And we paid a visit to the Seward House. And so this clip is from that visit to the Seward House in upstate New York.
Let's take a listen to Janice Adams, Jason Dole.
We're back here on the Janice Adams Show. We're traveling a path through history in upstate New York and on our way to Auburn.
Good morning. My name is Billy Chabot. I'm the executive director of the Seward House Museum here in Auburn, New York. The Seward House Museum is the family home of William Henry Seward. The home was built in 1816, and three generations of Seward family members lived here.
William Seward, Governor of New York, Senator from New York, Secretary of State in President Abraham Lincoln's cabinet, that team of rivals. The night the president was assassinated at Ford's Theater, Seward was also brutally attacked by pro-slavists. He almost died. His landmark home tells the story of how he lived.
It's a really interesting story about the Underground Railroad and Seward's connection with the Underground Railroad. In fact, it's his wife, Frances Seward, who is most active in the movement. You would consider Frances a staunch abolitionist. while Seward had more of a moderate approach. But we do know that during the 1850s, the home was used as a stop on the Underground Railroad. It is documented. So we have that story, that primary documentation that tells that story. And at this time, Seward is a United States senator. And to be harboring escaped slaves would have been considered an act of treason. So he was really taking a great risk.
The time that you're speaking about is, therefore, after the fugitive slave law. Do we have any stories about how he viewed that divide for himself?
We have lots of documentation. The Seward family were really voracious in their writing of letters back and forth to each other, in keeping of diaries. And it is really Frances that writes to her husband, often arguing that he take a harder approach to the slavery issue. He will make speeches and call it the irrepressible conflict that will eventually come to the fore. But Seward has even a longer history dating back before this time, where he's advocating for immigrants, and he's always seeming to be advocating for those underserved populations. His advocation for immigrants may be the reason that he loses the election to Abraham Lincoln in 1860.
The immigrants that he's talking about in that period are?
Irish Catholic immigrants.
And why do they need advocacy at that particular period of time?
One of our favorite stories that we tell on our tours here at the Seward House is, in 1859, a lot of people, including William H. Seward, think that he will get the Republican nomination for president that year.
Matt McVitty, Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Seward House Museum.
He doesn't, of course. Abraham Lincoln gets that nomination. And one of the reasons being, the Republican Party of the mid-19th century is cohesive in their views on the anti-slavery movement, but there's a lot of shades of gray in between. So one very famous abolitionist, Thaddeus Stevens, who knows Seward and has worked with Seward in the past, is interviewed in 1859, and he's asked, why are you giving your support to Abraham Lincoln, not William H. Seward? Mr. Seward has so much more political experience than Abraham Lincoln. Stevens replies, paraphrased, why would I give my support to a guy that ruined the public schools in New York by letting all these immigrants in? And that story, in short, is that when Seward is governor of New York in 1838, he visits New York City and finds that there's something like 15,000 school-aged kids that are not going to school. He looks into this and finds out that they're almost all the children of Irish Catholic immigrants that will not send their children to the schools in New York because the school uses the King James Bible as its only textbook. And Seward is a great believer in education being the great equalizer. So he takes a good chunk of state and a little bit of his own money and publishes a 207-volume set of books called The School District Library. And it's all math, language, science, non-denominational religion. He sends them to every school district within New York State and most prisons within New York State, saying this is what your curriculum is based on now. Not the King James Bible, but a vast amount of subjects that any young mind would need to know. And this did upset a lot of prominent Republicans of the 19th century, one of the reasons why Seward does lose that nomination to Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
I'm going to take you to the basement of the Seward House Museum. It's the original kitchen from the original construction, and we know that that was a site where passengers on the Underground Railroad were brought to, and it's documented.
What happened in this room? This room represents the Underground Railroad in the Seward House. Why?
Well, we call this room hollowed ground or hollowed space. And this was used as the stop on the Underground Railroad for two reasons. One, it had an exterior entrance at that point, so people could come and go freely. And also, you can see in front of us, we have this big hearth here. So we have a nice heating source as well as a cooking source. The existing documentation suggests that this was used continuously as a stop on the Underground Railroad, and usually for fugitive slaves that were then heading north to Oswego, who would then go across Lake Ontario into Kingston, Ontario.
It's after the fugitive slave law, so where do they hide?
The windows would have been covered. However, everyone in the house was aware when visitors were visiting.
And that is Janice Adams. And she joins us now here with more on, you know, that clip we played, you know, parallels into your thoughts about truth-telling in American history, not
Absolutely.
Only on Juneteenth, but the overall truth-telling and uncovering these hidden histories.
And you never know what you'll hear on the Janice Adams show, right?
Right.
That clip is so symbolic, because I just want to speak to that for one moment, because that is what will bring us together tonight. That clip, in 1 6-minute clip, we have the attack on pro-slavers, which is akin to the attack on the assassinations of the Minnesota legislators this week. We have the talk about immigrants and the trashing of immigrants. We're going through that now. We have the issue of the enslavement and the Underground Railroad. While Seward is an official, his wife in their home has an Underground Railroad station. The conflict and the contradictions and the need for sanctuary. We have this legislation even today that is proposed to shield legislator or addresses. Seward himself was brutally attacked. But we do not have support for gun control, and indeed we have legislation on the table to support silencers for guns. That is where we are, and we have to see where this country really is. Instead of this glorified view, this is not who we are. Unfortunately, this is who we are, just as much as our aspirations, and we have to deal with both. Tonight, when we come together, yes, I'll be dealing with that call for a new Emancipation Proclamation, but this is the context in which it's taking place. And the question is, when we gather tonight at Farm Arts Collective at 7:30, Willow Wisp Farm, all are invited, and indeed it is a pay-what-you-like event. It is not a ticketed event. But when we come together there, we will be asking, I will be asking, is this really what we want for our children? Because the slaves, the people enslaved, were not free after when they were told they should be. Fannie Lou Hamer had a statement, "If I am not free, no one is free." And because of that legacy, how many of us really are free from seeing the daily modern-day equivalent of slave couples, as we see people being surrounded and disappeared by American agents in masks and people just taken away? We are not free of that. We are not free because they were not free. It's time for our collective freedom.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the other voices that are going to be at Farm Arts Collective tonight, celebrating Juneteenth. Oliver King reading from Langston Hughes and others. Talk about the multiple voices in tonight's event a little bit.
Well, it will begin with, and that is something that I'm so grateful for, it will begin with Robin Graywolf Henderson, who is a Lenape person. He is a First Nations person. And we are, when we are speaking at Radio Catskill, and when we meet in Pennsylvania, in Delaware, in Damascus this evening, we are on Lenape land. And so the program will be opened by a Lenape person, a member of the Lenape Nation. And then we also have Adrian Jensen, who's the former Commissioner of Human Rights for Sullivan County, and Tanis Kowalczuk, who is the founder of Farm Arts Collective and co-owner of the Willow Wisp Farm. And then I will be doing a presentation
in honor of Juneteenth as well.
What do you hope folks take away from this night of memory and celebration at Farm Arts tonight?
Oh, isn't that interesting? That's the one question that I did not prepare myself to answer because there's so much. But I think the main thing will be to really make up our own minds to do something in the service of all of our rights, of human rights. Do something tomorrow that maybe you were a little afraid of doing yesterday. That, to me, is the mark of progress and conscience.
That's Janice Adams, host of The Janice Adams Show here on Radio Catskill, Saturdays at 11. And tonight she'll be at Farm Arts Collective with the other folks that we just mentioned celebrating Juneteenth. It's tonight at 7. There's more information at farmartscollective.org. Janice, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing the history and your thoughts, and also looking forward to your celebration tonight.
Thank you, Tim, for having me.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, David Dan unveils The Clock at the Deepwater Literary Festival, which starts tomorrow. It's a thought-provoking installation bending time and challenging perception. We'll learn more about David's newest work after this. It's Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. Primary election day in New York is Tuesday, June 24th. June 23rd is the last day to apply in person for a mail-in or absentee ballot. Ballots must be postmarked by June 24th and received by the Board of Elections that same day. Early voting has already begun and ends June 22nd. Hours vary by day. Polls are open on primary election day from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. This is Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns tomorrow in Narrowsburg for the weekend, and tomorrow one of our own Radio Catskill family members is featured. Listeners may know David Dan as one of our jazz hosts at the station, but David is an artist, writer, and designer in his own right whose work defies easy categorization, just like his newest exhibit, The Clock, which will be on view at the Narrowsburg Union. It's a multimedia installation that explores time transformation and human reckoning. The Clock merges sculpture, storytelling, and symbolism in a deeply personal and universal meditation on the passage of time. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with David Dan about the inspiration behind the piece, his unconventional artistic journey, and why this return to art feels both urgent and inevitable.
Good morning, David Dan, and welcome to Radio Catskill.
Valerie, it's great to be here.
I have to be honest with you. I don't know where to begin with you and your artistic work, your journalism, your commercial artwork, your contributions to the community, and WJFF. So let me first state for our listeners that you're here to talk about The Clock.
Yes.
And that is going to be exhibited at, the Narrowsburg Union on June 20th at 4 p.m., and it is part of the Deepwater Literary Festival that runs from Friday, June 20th to Sunday, June 22nd. The Clock is an amazing piece of work, and we're going to discuss that. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about your background in the community, your involvement with WJFF. I know you most recently as our lawnmower.
Yes, I did retire from that.
You do it all.
I'm a hell of a plumber, too.
I see you out there at all our labor-intensive events, and you don't shy away from hard work.
Well, hard work is what WJFF is all about. I've been a volunteer here at the station for really since 1986, for quite a long time, obviously, long before we even were on air and had a signal. And I had a few years as a board president of the Board of Trustees, and also worked on the programming committee. Actually, I still work on the programming committee.
Yes, you do.
Yes. So, and I was for a long time a radio host of several programs. And so I'm very familiar with WJFF. I love the station. I love what people have done here, accomplished here. It's truly amazing. And our current staff, yourself included, do exceptional work.
Well, I thank you.
You're welcome, and well-deserved.
Yes, and let's remind our listeners who've been around for a while the name of your two different jazz programs.
Yes, I started in 1990 doing a jazz program called Cross Current, and then I took a break for a couple of years and came back with a program called Blues Connotation, which was 1 hour of jazz and then 1 hour of blues.
Let's talk a little bit about your work in the commercial art field.
I went to college in fine art, studied painting and sculpture, mostly abstract kind of sculpture, until my third year when my professor in sculpture decided that he wanted to work from the figure. And he had our class, he hired a couple of models and had our class work in half life size from the model, creating, you know, traditional sort of Rodin-type sculptures that we would then cast in plaster, which was really an interesting process. And it kind of opened up a whole new skill set for me that I really wasn't aware I had at that point. I went on to graduate school in Chicago and picked up other interesting sort of philosophical approaches to fine art. But because I had this skill in creating convincing figurative work, I eventually got work in New York City as a commercial sculptor. So I would make models for toy companies they were prototypes that would then be cast as action figures or My Little Pony or various things of that nature. G.I. Joe was a series that I worked on for a while.
Wow.
Yes.
You continue to surprise, Mr. Dan.
Well, all this stuff was sort of in the shadows, you know?
Yes.
Certainly in terms of my work here at WJFF, the two just didn't seem to have any connection, so I didn't really ever talk about it. But for many years, I was the sculptor, the go-to sculptor for holography, white light holograms, like people might remember or even notice that they have, there's a little hologram of a dove on the Visa card, their Visa
yes.
credit card. That's an actual model that was one that I made many years ago. There were several other sculptors who worked on that as well, but some of those cards have my little tiny dove, and they're all done in one-to-one scale. So you have to work very, very small for most of those pieces. And so that was quite a nice livelihood for quite a while.
And also, did you do some work for the Museum of Natural History in the city?
The American Museum, yes, I did a number of pieces for them. A couple of prehistoric turtle models, which was really interesting. Yes, they were all spiky and dinosaur-looking, kind of weird.
What fun!
Creepy things. And they're in permanent display. But the most interesting thing that I did for them was a life-size model of the skeletal remains of Archaeopteryx, which is the first evidence of dinosaurs becoming feathered birds. So I call it my chicken. It was sculpted. The bones were very fine, but I had to make them all in epoxy and sculpt them, and then they were painted. An interesting sideline to this story is that I created the model. It took about 7 months to do it. I packed it very carefully, shipped it off to the American Museum. It arrived at their loading dock, and it was never seen again. So they called me up and said, where's the model? I said, well, it was I have a receipt here that said it arrived at your loading dock. They could not find it. So I wound up doing it twice.
Oh, dear. And you got better?
It got better. But the best part is that somehow the model must have been shipped into the trash, went off to Staten Island, was buried in the landfill, and in a million years, it will become a fossil all over again. Love yes. It. So I did work for the American Museum. I also worked for the Field Museum in Chicago doing dioramas. And
let's move on a little to your small edition works. And some of those I see are in the collection at the New Museum and Franklin Furnace and the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art.
For my fine artwork, which is sort of going on in the background of all this other activity, I started to make pieces that were kind of occupied both an art sensibility and also a utilitarian sense. So they looked like functional objects that were like what you might buy in the store, take home and use for opening cans or something like that. But they were quirky and kind of occupied this uneasy space between is it real or is it something else? And these were small objects made in multiple editions, and I sold them through museum stores and art shops, you know, that featured, there were quite a few in New York City and Chicago and Los Angeles that featured small works by artists like myself. And I did that instead of having these things be in a gallery situation, which would immediately remove them from the utilitarian sense that I wanted. They would be, you know, kind of hung on a wall or put on a pedestal, and that gave them a sort of rarefied, arty kind of a feeling, which I wasn't very happy with. I didn't like that idea. So those were small pieces, many, as I said, made in multiple editions, sold not in galleries, but, you know, you could buy them for $10 at a store.
And were those some pieces that you had at the art show at
Delaware Valley?
Yes.
Yes. There were a number of small pieces, the pocket universe, but the platometer was there, you know, as a device for determining aesthetic experiences for yourself, you see.
That can bring us to Artenall.
Yes, Artenall was this was a magazine, a national magazine, in fact, that I worked on in collaboration with Alex Melamed, who was part of the Russian expatriate art duo Komar and Melamed. Vitaly Komar was his partner. They're very well known for the Bulldozer show that took place in Moscow between the hours of noon and 2 o'clock one afternoon and was bulldozed by the authorities because it was illegal. Anyway, Alex has a really unusual take on contemporary art, which is fairly satirical. And he contacted me, and we got together and put together a magazine called Artenall, which was a curative for contemporary art. And the name came from the analgesic Tylenol. So Alex said, it's got to be Artenall. And it was unusual because it was a quarterly journal that had an unusual shape. It was die cut to fit.
I remember it.
Yeah, so each issue was oddly shaped like a children's book, you know. It was kind of whatever was on the cover, it was trimmed to follow that profile. And it contained lots of interesting writings from well-known authors as well as fictional authors, of which I was one.
You were one. I remember that. And I remember, I believe it was the first edition, was Nietzsche.
Yes, Nietzsche. It was all about taking Nietzsche's theories about the existence of God and changing it into, you know, does art really exist and is it, you know, necessary any longer?
Before we move on to the clock, I just wanted to ask you and share with our listeners your involvement with local journalism, the Town Crier and now Manor, Inc.
Yes. Wow. Okay. Well, we're covering all the bases.
Well, it's important. I mean, you've contributed a lot to our community, and what we do here at JFF is all about community.
It certainly is.
And, you know, I will always thank you for mowing our lawn.
Now, that's really something that's essential.
Yes.
I got involved with journalism through Barbara Greff, and my sculpting work was sort of petering out, and I needed a way to put food on the table. So she said, well, come down and work for the Record. And I did. And it was an interesting experience because I'd done quite a lot of work in graphics prior to that, but mostly in advertising. And newspapers are a whole different bag. And I learned really extraordinary amount of skills from just simply hanging out in the newsroom and pushing out daily papers, you know, on a 24/7 kind of situation. Yeah. And learned how to create a newspaper. And later, Barbara and I, along with Van Morrow, who's a longtime supporter of WJ, got purchased from Carolyn Bivens a paper called The Town Crier, which was located in Livingston Manor. And we did that for 4 or 5 years. It was a weekly, and it was a massive amount of work, but lots of fun. And then one thing led to another, and I left the paper. But Carolyn Bivens approached me about 6 years ago and said, you know, Manor Inc. is this little newspaper in Livingston Manor that is staffed by kids, by high school kids. And would you be interested in taking over the graphic work for it? And I said, sure. And so it's been six years of producing a monthly paper that has been award-winning. The New York Press Association was a three-time winner of Outstanding Student Publication and lots of awards for stories in the paper. And it's been a great experience.
And it's still going on.
Still going on. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
So now let's talk about the clock, your inspiration for this particular artwork.
Well, many different sources for inspiration. I had retired from creating art back in the 90s since I had solved the art question for myself, which I won't belabor for you. But I started up doing work again about 2 or 3 years ago. And part of that was writing. I was writing stories. And another part was I had the desire to sculpt again. And these stories seemed to be about people in transition, largely based on my own experiences, but taking them, adding a fictitious quality to them. And I had been, as a child, very impressed by a book by this wonderful illustrator and author named Howard Pyle. It was called The Wonder Clock. It's 24 stories, one for each hour of the day. And the stories were these sort of charming fable-like stories illustrated by Pyle's wonderful sort of neoclassical drawings, pen and ink drawings. And I'd always been inspired by that book as a possibility for outlining transition over a period of time. I also had a clock that my great-grandfather put together that was probably created in the 1880s. He created a new cabinet for it about 1890, and it had wooden gears. It was really interesting, and it ran and still runs. And I thought, why not create a clock that would talk about my art philosophy through these series of stories in a progression from early days to, you know, contemporary times. And this clock would symbolize the end of motion, the end of time, the end, in other words, the culmination of existence. And it would do so because it would have two sets of hands, each set running in opposite directions, so they would cancel each other out, which to me signified the end of time, which then would be the existence of God, that everything ceases to move, all is. Simple, right?
Very simple. Yes.
Yeah, really.
So will folks be able to read the stories?
Yes. Now, that's an interesting thing, Val, because I was thinking about Warhol and his soup cans, you know, very mundane objects. He painted pictures of them in a traditional artistic medium, hung them on the wall. And that was not what you would expect an artist to do. You didn't think of soup cans as art, or, you know, boxes of Brillo pads as art. And I thought, why not do that with publications? Because for all these years, I've been creating these magazines, newspapers, all these things, and no one ever looks at them as art. They're a means of, you know, conveying content, and then they pitch them in the recycle, kind of like a soup can. So I thought, I'm going to create these articles, these things that I've written, as actual magazines or journal or ebook manifestations, frame them and hang them on the wall. So there are 12 of them. They're in various publications that actually exist, Psychology Today, The New Yorker, a number of other they're all magazines and journals that are real. They have these stories and they're displayed like art. Next to each of these 12 framed story publications are QR codes that viewers can click, and it will take you to the actual story, and you can read it, or you can listen to it, because they're all read by AI. So you can, you know, spend 12 hours, one hour for each of the 12 hours and the two combined hours of the clock. So it's a multimedia experience. You have the sculptural aspect, you have the stories themselves, and then there's this sort of aesthetic view of these things as framed artworks.
Talk a little bit about the sculpture itself and Adam and Eve and the apple.
The sculpture consists of a chopped off tree on a kind of rocky landscape with these two figures flanking it. One is Adam, as you say. The other is Eve. They're based on maquettes. Sculptures by Rodin. One is a maquette, the female sculpture. The other is based on one of the shades from the Gates of Hell, a very famous sculpture by Rodin. And in the middle is the clock. And it is a clock, as I said, with hands running in opposite directions. It's a wooden clock. It actually works. The drive weight is the fateful apple. And the clock itself symbolizes, or the Adam and Eve symbolize, the beginning of time, which is basically in biblical terms when time begins, and the clock itself symbolizes the end of time. So it's those two things together, and the figures are half life size, so they're fairly, there's 35, 36 inches high. They're pretty big, and dramatic, I think, if the lighting is good.
Well, will you be there?
I will be there. Yes, I'll be there. I'm told there will be wine.
That I saw that. And so after I read the description of it, I said, I'm glad there'll be a glass of wine.
Yeah, right.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming in. And thank you for all you've done over the years for our community up here.
Well, you're very kind. And thank you, Valerie, for all your work on this program and many other programs, and the programming committee and endless other things. You know, that's how WJFF works.
Yes, that's how community works.
And
adios.
Adios.
Oh, and adios to all of you. Thanks for culture reporter Valerie Manzi and our own David Dan as well. A reminder, the Deepwater Literary Fest returns to Narrowsburg starting tomorrow through the weekend. The theme is metamorphosis and transformation, and the full program is available at deepwaterfestival.com. Radio Catskill is a proud media sponsor of the festival. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the summer concert series that's presented by the Wayne County Creative Arts Council in Honesdale. This is Radio Catskill.
Donna Fellenberg here, and this week on Catskill Character, I have that ukulele-playing chanteuse, world-renowned mezzo-soprano, resident of Pike County, drag queen persona Blythely Oratonio, better known as the fabulous Stephanie Blythe, Don't miss her this Saturday at 10:30 on Catskill Character on Radio Catskill.
This is Callison Stratton, host of Liberation Station, a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers. Liberation Station airs Saturday nights at 7 o'clock, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For more than 50 years, the Wayne Corlaers have brought music and community together, performing a wide range of concerts as one of the cornerstones of the Wayne County Creative Art Council's Summer Concert Series in Honesdale's Central Park. I recently spoke with Dave Figura, stage manager and booking coordinator of the concert series, about their upcoming schedule, which includes the Corlaers, and the history of the Wayne County Creative Arts Council.
So the history of the Wayne County Creative Arts Council goes back to the late 60s, about 58 years ago, when a gentleman by the name of Art Fossauer and also the Wayne County Corlaers decided to coordinate concerts. And these were first conducted at a local elementary school where they used some cinder blocks and plywood to, for like a stage. Eventually, the concerts grew with different groups, local groups mostly, and they moved into the park, into Central Park in Honesdale, where they were pretty much on a flatbed trailer for many years. When I had moved from college back into the area, this was about 1985-86, I was recruited by Art to help him out with the sound system, which was pretty barbaric by any means. It was basically some PA horns. And throughout the next several years, we started adding equipment and getting other groups involved in the, in playing in the park. Some of those were dance troupes, some of them were polka bands, some jazz bands, and the Corlaers had been there throughout. Also, the old-time fiddlers have become a mainstay of the attractions in the park. Somewhere around the late 80s, early 90s, Art had retired from doing this. And my mother, May Figura, who's taught dance in the area for many, many years, and her and some of her friends, the Lautenschlagers and the Keelers and some other local people from Honesdale, started taking over the coordination of the summer events. And once again, I was recruited to do sound. So I've been doing this since about 1986, working as basically a sound and light engineer and stage coordinator. The Arts Council has been going on for about 58 years now and putting on the shows in the park. Normally, we do about 14 concerts. They run from the middle of June through the end of July on Mondays and Thursdays. The exceptions are when they have the fireworks in Honesdale, we do that on the fireworks night. And that is typically a couple days before the 4th of July.
Yeah, I think this year it's Tuesday, July 1st. You guys have a lot of events, as you said, throughout the summer, and they're all free. So how do you fund the events?
Okay, so they are free to the public. In the spring, we send out donation letters to people, to patrons that have given in the past. So that's a good amount of our budget there. We also pass the hat at intermission at these events, and it's a free will offering. There is no obligation to give any money, but if you can, that's wonderful. And we also work hand in hand with the Wayne County Community Foundation. For last year, we got a nice grant to get a new equipment trailer. And this year, through the VM family, there has been a nice donation to get new upgraded sound and lighting equipment. And also the Wayne County Parks and Recs have secured a brand new state-of-the-art stage line stage, mobile stage. So it looks very professional. And most of the money for the acts come from local patrons, either businesses or just private people, either giving through the donations at the beginning of the spring or during the concerts.
You mentioned the Wayne County Corollaires, their concert's coming up June 23rd. Lots of other music coming up. And also, you've got the Honesdale Women's Club Arts and Antique Show, July 12th and 13th. What are some of the things you look forward to during this summer festival of events?
Well, one of my favorite things, but I would say my favorite night of the year, and I'm not on stage with this one, but I love these people, and it's just a great community concert, and that's the Old Time Fiddlers. Mm-hmm. And they've been with the they've been playing these concerts for years and years. I don't know when they started, but it's a group of 20 plus individuals that play a lot of fiddles, some guitars, mandolins. You have a piano player and a bass player who also plays a cello, and this is organized by Steve Jacoby. And it's just a wonderful night of the year. That's one of my favorites. And I do get to play with a couple of very good friends of mine, E. Cat and Friends. She's a wonderful local talent. And I'm looking forward to some of the newer groups that we're having this year as well, including the Outcrops, the Wannabes, the Brass Roots, which is a swing band that also covers Motown and like Chicago or Earth, Wind, and Fire type songs. There's a new band coming in that's playing classic country up until about the 90s, and they're very popular already in the area. We have, really popular local group called Graham Baxter. There's the Luongo Brothers, who used to be the Poets Band, legendary in this area, the Fabulous 45s, which is the very popular group, and a good friend of mine is playing in a group called Lighten Up. That's Randy Light and his wife and friends. We have our first concert is actually, well, by the time this airs, it would have gone, but it's the Honesdale Harmonizers, which is a barbershop group, and the Highland Handbells, which is a handbell choir. And forgive me if I am missing anybody, but I think I've got just about everybody listed there.
I think you did. It's a big schedule. Where can folks see the schedule and get more information?
Okay, so if you go on to Facebook, Wayne County Creative Arts Council, there will be links there to where you could send donations or get a hold of us personally. My email or my phone number should be on that site, as far as prospective bookings. So if you have a band and you would like to try to get into the park, the bands are voted on by the board members. So it's not my personal, not just my choice, but at least I can present this to the board in the fall after this year's concert, and we'll see what we can do.
That's Dave Figuera, stage manager and booking coordinator for the 58th Annual Summer Festival Events presented by the Wayne County Creative Arts Council at Central Park in Honesdale. Dave, it sounds like another great summer. Have a great time. Thanks for being here.
And thank you very much.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Tonight on the local edition, it's an update from Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley editor for the Times Union, with a roundup of the events and news in the Hudson Valley. And a reminder, if you wanted a roundup of all of the news and information that's happening at Radio Catskill, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It'll be in your inbox tomorrow morning if you sign up today at wjffradio.org. Soundings newsletter, local news and information from Radio Catskill every week in your inbox for free. WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guests are two culinary icons. Alice Waters, founder of Chez Panisse Restaurant and a pioneer of the farm-to-table movement, and Thomas Keller, the world-famous visionary behind the French Laundry. They're featured in the Netflix series Chef's Table Legends. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Sunny skies this morning, but scattered showers and thunderstorms developing during the afternoon and lingering into the early evening. Some of those storms could be severe. High 82 today, 57 for the low tonight, and looking ahead to the weekend, 75, partly cloudy tomorrow, partly cloudy 81 Saturday, 85 Sunday.